From Beyond Marketing, it's the 20-Minute Call, a podcast about the dreamers, boundary pushers, rebels, and champions of the skydiving industry. Each episode is a narrative journey highlighted by the highs, lows, and luck that the skydiving industry delivers, as told by the most influential people within the sport. If you've ever dreamed of becoming a skydiver, perhaps opening a drop zone, or becoming the next world champion, check out the 20-Minute Call hosted by me, James LeBarry. My guest today is a special guest for this program and a person that I'm honored to have. This isn't just a person who's done big things in skydiving, though he has, but he's a dear personal friend of mine, and I don't know where I would be. I certainly wouldn't be hosting this podcast. I probably wouldn't even be in the United States of America if it wasn't for the gentleman sitting across from the table from me. And that is DZO Danny Smith, drop zone owner of Skydive Carolina, which he founded in 1986. Danny has been instrumental to many people, many lives, and of course, this sport, who many people are indebted to. And it is my honor and privilege to welcome you, Danny, to the 20-Minute Call podcast. Thank you for being here.
Thank you, Coach. It's a pleasure to be here.
Yeah, a real honor. You and I have been through some things together.
We have done several things together over our lives. It's been amazing. Actually, I got to see where you came from, Antigo, twice. I wouldn't have had that opportunity if it hadn't been meeting you.
We'll get into the stories of how our lives became intertwined. I know for our followers of this program, they probably have heard me reference you several times. So it's time to introduce you to our listeners. So let's begin with your background. You're originally from Asheville, North Carolina. Can you share some details about your childhood?
I can. Actually, I grew up on a farm. My parents, of course, they divorced at a young age. I was only in the fifth grade when they divorced. And my grandparents actually raised me. It was right outside of Asheville, a little town called Marshall, North Carolina. And my grandfather was a tobacco farmer. And so that's where I spent my childhood. Never smoked a day in my life, but tobacco was our primary source of income at the time. And so that's where I got. I love sports, as you know. And I played all three sports in high school. And the one that I really kind of excelled in was basketball. So I loved that. And so that's what I did. That's where I grew up. And I loved it's so funny. Back when you're that young, and I had all these chores I had to do on the farm, because we had cows and pigs and you name it, all that. As a young boy, I didn't like all those chores I had to do. But looking back on it, that was one of the highlight of my life, and I would do it all over again. It was so much fun when I think about it now as an adult.
So would you say you came from humble beginnings?
I did. Again, my grandparents were dirt farmers, basically. Didn't have a lot of money, but they didn't need a lot of money because, honestly, this is a true story about my grandmother. To the day that she passed, she had never stepped foot in a grocery store. Everything was raised on the farm. We had a garden, which I spent a lot of time in that garden hoeing weeds and picking vegetables and all that. We had pigs, hogs. That's a funny story in itself. I can tell you about that. We had cows that we slaughtered for the beef. Everything was raised. I ate good as a young boy and a teenager because it was all organic food right there on the farm. Quick funny story about the pigs that we raised. So when we got them, they're just little baby pigs, right? And they turn into, you know, several hundred pound hogs. Well, that was one of my jobs. I had to feed them every day. We call it slopping the hogs on the farm, but it's feeding the hogs. So now, fast forward to the fall, that becomes slaughter day, right? Now, I had to feed these animals every day. There's two of them every year. I named them because they were my pets. They loved me because I came and fed them all the time. On the day that they get slaughtered, my uncles and my dad would come in and help my grandfather do that. Well, how did they get rid of them? They shot them with a .22 rifle. When I heard that first pig squeal the first year I did that, I was in the fifth grade, it just tore me up. So every slaughter day after that, I had to leave the farm. I couldn't be there. But I did eat the meat. But yeah, that's some of my humbling beginnings right there.
You were eating organic long before it was ever called organic.
I didn't even know what the word meant. But yeah, everything that I ate at that time came off the farm. I had a little, there was a little peddler truck, a little green wooden truck, I'll never forget it, from a local grocery store, a little small, you know, country grocery store. He would peddle around the neighborhoods, and that's when my grandmother would get her, like, salt, pepper, things like that. But everything else was right there raised on the farm. She literally would can more than 300 cans of vegetables every year, and that is just amazing.
How were you as a student?
As a student, I was very good at math, struggled in some of the other ones. Got a funny story about that one I can tell you, too. But I did okay. I mean, I made A's and B's and C's. And the funny story is, when I got into college in Western Carolina, one of our English teachers, and I was pretty good at English and pretty good at writing at the time, so she said, okay, pick a number, pick a story. I want you to write a story on whatever you want to write on. And this is when I was a skydiver, so that's really almost on skydiving. All my other papers, I got A's and B's. I wrote one on skydiving, I got a C. So, you know, I wrote it from my perspective, not for somebody to read, and I didn't make very good on that one.
Now, before you went to college, didn't you enroll in the Air Force?
I did. Of course, I didn't have money to go to college. So when I graduated from high school, I went straight into the Air Force and spent 4 years there. And then when I got out of Air Force is when I went to college at Western Carolina on the GI Bill, of course. So I was able to, you know, earn some money being in the military to do that. Yeah, my military background was at Barksdale Air Force Base in Shreveport, Louisiana. And that's a B-52 bomber base is what that is. That's where I got the love of skydiving. Every year at Barksdale, they would have an open house day. All the civilians could come into the base, had all these displays of airplanes there, and the Thunderbirds airbag team would perform. And then one year, in 1966, the Golden Knights parachute team jumped in. Well, that just intrigued me to know. I didn't even know about skydiving then in the area. So when they jumped in, I was just amazed. And I talked to a couple of them about it, and they told me where they were from, Fort Bragg and all that. And they talked a little bit to me about sport skydiving. And they even said, hey, you need to reach out. There might be something right here in your area. Well, I did. And it turns out there was a local skydiving club called the Arklatex Skydivers. The three words was Arkansas, Texas, Louisiana, Arklatex. And that's where I got my start, was there. And that's how I got it, was watching the Golden Knights jump into that annual event at Barksdale Air Force Base.
Wow, you're another product of the Golden Knights.
I was. How about that?
When you were, I mean, were you, I don't want to stereotype, but were you sort of a young country kid, not really been out of North Carolina, and suddenly you're in the Air Force and you're in Louisiana on a base, and suddenly you see, you know, these jumpers, like, were you sort of young and impressionable?
I grew up in the Air Force. Yes, I did. At the time that I saw them, because I went in the Air Force when I was 17 years old. And then the first year I saw them, I was 19, because it was 2 years later. I was 19 years. And yes, being in the Air Force taught me so much. And as a young kid, being opposed, because I'd never been out of the Asheville area. Now, where I grew up on the farm was out of, even Asheville was a big town to me. Well, get there, Shreveport was fairly big as well. I'm sure it's, other than maybe Baton Rouge, it's the biggest city in Louisiana. But I'd never been exposed to anything like that. Heck, I didn't even know what a beer looked like. Well, as a military person, I was introduced to a lot of the clubs in the area. So, yeah, I got my taste there. And I had never seen that ever, living on the farm, never.
So when you leave the Air Force, you go back to Asheville. And then, you know, you got a hankering for some jumping still. And the closest place is the Charlotte Skydivers Club.
Well, even before that, I was a skydiver. I didn't have that many jumps when I arrived back in Asheville. Turns out that there was a club in Spartanburg, South Carolina, called the Spartan Skydivers. I went down there a couple times and made a few jumps down there, but not many. And then, this is, if we get into this story, you're going to find out that most of my jumping is demonstration jumping. Well, a local DJ moved into the Asheville area, and he was a skydiver. And then I heard him over the radio talk about that, so I called him just to let him know where the Spartan skydivers were. He said, "Well, glad to meet you." He said, "I've got a couple of demos lined up. Would you like to jump in?" I said, "Yeah, well, never have, but okay." So there was a half mile, well, not even a half mile, it was 0.4 mile NASCAR racetrack called the New Asheville Speedway. So my first demo jump that I made with not even 50 jumps was into that speedway right by the French Broad River. And I don't mind telling you, I was petrified. And again, it was under round parachutes, had a paracommander at the time, it was PC, we called it. And so that was my first demo jump, was into the New Asheville Speedway.
And how many jumps did you have again for that demo?
I had less than 50.
I mean, if anyone jumped into a demo with 50 jumps a day, I mean, it would be negligence.
No way could you do it. And especially, I mean, we pulled it off. We both did well. We made several jumps into that speedway. And then we actually jumped into a mountaintop raceway, which was a go-kart track. And we did a couple of jumps into that, and it was right on the side of a mountain. So I got exposed to demo jumping very early in my skydiving career.
And then that would advance with your demo jumping, because in 1976, you happened to meet this gentleman named Paul McCowan.
Yes, I did.
And he sort of made an offer that I believe you would probably say were maybe the best skydiving years of your life.
Absolutely. When I met Paul, I didn't know him. And there's three parks, Kings Island in Cincinnati, Kings Dominion in Virginia, and then Carowinds here in Charlotte. Carowinds was not owned by the parent company of Kings Island, Kings Dominion, but then they bought Carowinds, and they became part of that. Paul, he was from the Ohio area, Cincinnati. He already had a skydiving team jumping into Kings Island in Cincinnati. He also had a skydiving team jumping in Kings Dominion. And then when they bought Carowinds, well, then he put together a team for that. Here we go again with the Golden Knights. So the very first year, I was not captain of the team. I was just one of the team with two former Golden Knights that he hired out of Fort Bragg. He got that recommendation from Gene Paul Thacker, one of my mentors we'll talk about later. But then Paul, he jumped in the first couple of shows into Carowinds Park. Well, he needed a third jumper. And it's funny, not a funny story, but when Paul landed in one of the jumps, and again, it was round parachutes at the time, paracommanders, PCs, he landed by the space needle, and you've been to Carowinds. He landed by the space needle, which is on pavement. Well, he hammered in and blew out his knee. That's when he needed a third jumper, because he didn't have one on the team at the time. So he contacted Gene Paul Thacker and said, "Hey, you got anybody locally that I could talk to?" And that's how he said, "Yeah, call to Danny Smith. He might be available." And so I went to him. He was in the hospital, and that's where I signed my contract while he was in the hospital. And that's when I became a member with those two Golden Knights that first year. And then year two on, I was captain of the team, and I put together a local team, and then we jumped from year two on.
If you're a DZO or DZM listening to this podcast, and you're not using Burble, I've got a question. Why not? If the reason is price, what's the cost of your time? Other booking and manifest softwares are a one-size-fits-all. Burble was built from the ground up by a DZO for DZOs to maximize efficiency. Now, isn't that nice? There's no software that compares. Choose Burble.
Burble.
What did your family think of you getting into this crazy skydiving thing?
It's so funny. My mom, who at the time lived in Sebastian, Florida, she thought I was crazy because she didn't know anything about skydiving. But coincidentally, where she lived in Sebastian, she originally was in Michigan. But when they divorced, she moved back. She moved to Sebastian, Florida. Well, she lived so close to Skydive Sebastian that jumpers actually landed in her backyard. So she began to like it pretty good. And funny. She enjoyed some of the conversations we had, some of the pictures I showed to her, and she liked it very well. She came around and she supported it. In fact, she's been to Skydive Carolina. She came before, God rest her soul, before she passed. At one of my birthdays, she was up for that from down there, from Sebastian. And so she got to see me jump, so that was pretty cool.
Wow, that is pretty cool. So tell us a little bit about jumping into Carowinds. I'll say for our audience listening, Carowinds is an amusement park, as Danny mentioned, and it's tight, especially where they wanted you guys to land, and you guys are jumping rounds.
The first year we jumped rounds. From year two on, we had square parachutes. First year, they landed by the space needle on the asphalt, which I was telling you about. But when Paul blew his knee out, he said, look, we got to find another place to jump in the park area. They used to have a wooden roller coaster called Thunder Road. And so right by that was a little bitty grass strip there, a little grass, patch of grass. Well, that's when they moved it to there. So I never had to jump by the space needle on the concrete or the asphalt. I'm glad of that. When I started jumping, it was in that little grassy plain, but it was small. I mean, I'm looking around at your conference room here. It wasn't much bigger than this. And so it was pretty tight. On year two, well, actually, first year we had the rounds, but we still managed to get there. And interesting story, so when we did that, one of the things we had to do was stand up. If we didn't stand up landing, we didn't get paid. So the pressure's on. And so we did, at that particular year, we did 70 shows into the park every weekend. And then we did about 20-some shows every year outside the park, promoting Carowinds and Firestone Tire and Rubber, which was our main sponsor. We did all kinds of shows, and we'll get into some of that also. But then year two came around, and we got the square parachutes. And really, other than that, yeah, when you're under canopy, it looked pretty tight. But being an accuracy jumper, and that's what I did back in my day, I competed in style and accuracy. It wasn't that difficult to do. Another interesting story of that, so there's three of us on the team. And our air show coordinator for Carowinds, he surprised us one night. We were flying over, because the air show consisted of a hot air balloon, two aerobatic airplanes, and a skydiving team. I looked down, and there was a little small miniature pea gravel pit that he had put in there as a surprise. So the three of us, the three jumpers, we decided, okay, whoever lands out the longest has to buy beer that night. So that was a little game we played on the side. I didn't buy much beer because I was pretty good at that point.
You know, maybe, I mean, we've been friends a long time, and I've heard you tell this story many times because it may be the highlight, the cherry on the top of landing on the USS Yorktown in 1978, which, for those listening, is a very large aircraft carrier that's in, docked in Charleston, South Carolina. Tell us about that story, Danny.
Yeah, let me tell you how that story happened. That was pretty interesting how it even happened. So we did, again, we did a lot of shows outside the park as part of the sponsorship for Carowinds and Firestone. We did the Azalea Festival in Wilmington, North Carolina. And Wilmington, North Carolina, the USS Yorktown, North Carolina battleship is parked there. Right beside of that is a little park with some grass and all that. And so we did that show, and we landed on the grass, of course, not on the battleship. Our Firestone rep happened to be there. And as I landed, he walked up to me and said, "Hey, Danny, I got an idea. You think you could land on an aircraft carrier?" I said, "I don't see why not. We're..." So he told me about the Yorktown. I said, "Well, we'd have to look at it to make sure." So he arranged for us to be, we flew down there, went on the deck, went on the ship, checked it out. It was like, of course we can do this. The ship is 888 feet long, 120 feet wide. No problem. We can take this. No problem. Now, it is 70 feet tall. Keep that in mind. So the day of that jump that we did that show, it was borderline winding. It was so windy that day. And I was captain of the team, so I told the other two members of my team, Bob Norris and Reggie Wilson, I said, "Look, guys, this is individual. If you don't feel comfortable to do this show, you don't have to, but I'm going to jump. When else are we going to have a chance to jump on an aircraft carrier?" And they had boats in the water just in case if we missed it. We also had life vests on underneath our jumpsuits, and we came in there and nailed it. And we jumped out at 7,000 feet. And like I said, when I was standing there, when I checked it out, I said, "Piece of cake." at 7,000 feet, it looked like a little canoe sitting down there. Now, the other thing about that jump was so interesting because it was so windy. The ship is 880 feet long, sits in there east and west, 120 feet wide, north and south. So how's the wind blowing that day? North and south. So literally, if we're setting up to come into the wind, we only had 60 feet to deal with. And we pulled it off, but it is the highlight jump of my career, especially doing all the demos we did. We did so many demos out of the park. I've got 15 or 20 jumps in Charlotte Motor Speedway as an example. We did the Sun Fun Festival in Myrtle Beach. We did the Peach Festival in Gaffney, and of course the one just said in Wilmington, and that was Stiletto Festival in Charleston when we did the Yorktown jump. And we did many more. We did air shows for at airports and all of that. That was the highlight of my jump. I actually, with Paul, some of the shows he got us into, we did, if anybody remembers the movie Honeymoon in Vegas, and that's where the Flying Elvis came in, the skydiving team. Well, that's what Paul did. Now, that was under copyright, so he couldn't call us the Flying Elvis. So we were the E-Team skydivers, and we were jumped like Elvis. We did some night demos with Pyro, and so I got to do some of those, too. And there's a very interesting story in that. We did one in Knoxville, Tennessee, for the opening of Regal Theaters. And so as we're getting dressed in the room, the local TV station came in there to interview Paul about us jumping in. And so they're doing the interview. So the lady reporter who was interviewing said, well, you are an Elvis impersonator, so you must sing. So how about giving us a song to sing? He said, well, I'm not the singer of the group. He is. And he points to me. So I did him a couple of renditions of You Ain't Nothing But a Hound Dog or something like that. So now we go out to go do the show. And so here we are, four Elvises walking towards our airplane to board that to go do the show. This King Air lands, and these little old gray-haired ladies get off of that. And what do they see? Four Elvis Presleys walking at them. So they come over there just screaming and shouting and won't know what we're all about, and we told them all that. And so the pilot gets off the airplane. They send him back in the plane to get the camera so he could take a picture of us with, or they could take a picture with all these Elvises. And when we do those shows, it was so cool because once you land, because we had helmets on and all that like we did, but we had wigs on, of course, the hair. We had, you know, if anybody remembers Elvis, when he would do his concerts, he had these gold rim glasses. So what our ground crew would do would pick out a lady or ladies in the audience and assign one of them to each one of us. So they would come to us when we landed, and then we'd have to gently take our helmet off, not to mess with the wig, and then they would put those glasses on our face. That was part of the routine. And so that was some fun time. We did that as well.
Danny, what is impressive to me is it takes a nerve, a special kind of nerve, to do a demo. You know, it's not like you were on the Golden Knights and you know, right. Got tons of jumps to train. I mean, you were a fairly inexperienced by today's standards to be jumping these demos. But where did you get your nerve from? I mean, I imagine you got into some pretty tight corners and probably scared yourself a little bit. But where'd you find the courage when it looked crazy to even exit the plane?
That's a good question. There was a couple Yorktown being one, but I can tell you another one. But before I get to that, how did I get that experience? Back in the day, there was a Carolina Sport Parachute Council, and that was for style and accuracy. And as a young jumper, when I was a member of the Charlotte Skydivers Club, we went to all the meets. And so I grew up doing accuracy, and I won a few trophies doing that. But I had good teachers, and Jimmy Davis, who was one of my teachers, he was on the U.S. Style and accuracy team two times, had over 6,000 or 7,000 jumps. And I had some good mentors that taught me how to do accuracy. And then with the proper canopy, it wasn't that hard to do. But back to the Yorktown, that was pretty tight to do. But the tightest one that I really did here in Charlotte, and you may know about it, Coach, is the Old English, I'm a little bit lost on the name now, but there's a tennis court over in the Providence area, and it's a stadium course, where they got stadium seats all around this one tennis court. Well, we did a demo into that. And so I assumed, okay, they're going to take down the net. No, they left it up. And this had stadium seats all around that. And you had to literally come over the seats and just sink it down and get in there and land on half of a tennis court. That one got my attention way more than the Yorktown did, because that was the tightest one I've ever had to do. We did one in Faith, North Carolina at a 4th of July celebration, the biggest celebration in the state of North Carolina every year. All the dignitaries there, the governors, all these people were always there. On that one, I'm coming in. I was the last one. We land on a ball field, and I was the last one to come in, and the winds picked up. And I'm out past the outfield fence, and I said, I'm not going to make it. And I didn't have nowhere to go because there's trees everywhere. I wasn't going to make it, I thought. So I barely picked my feet up and just barely landed on the other side, but that one I almost didn't make. And then we jumped into the Charlotte Knights, a AAA baseball team here in town. When they opened up this was a good story too. When they opened up their new stadium and they were introducing the crowd to their new mascot, which is Homer the Dragon. Well, we brought in Homer the Dragon and landed on the ball field. And of course, when we landed, they took the skydiving Homer the Dragon out behind the dugout, and the real Homer the Dragon came out on a four-wheeler. So, and that was pretty cool, because I enjoyed doing that one. We had all of the jumpers, we had a bet on that, who could land closest to the pitching mound. I dead-centered it. Got lucky on that one.
Danny, while all this is going on, you're actually now working as a banker.
I was.
First Union National Bank in downtown Charlotte.
Correct.
I also am aware that the Charlotte Skydivers Club was winding down. So you're really doing demos all the time. Charlotte Skydivers Club, really the only drop zone for the area, is kind of petering out. And it's determined, or you decide, I'm going to find a solution to this and open up a drop zone. Is that right?
Yeah, here's how that happened. Because Charlotte Skydivers Club was a nonprofit club, just a club. In fact, at the time, it was one of the oldest skydiving clubs in the U.S. It was formed in 1959. It consisted of three board of directors and a bunch of officers, and that was it. So I got elected to the board. I was also the treasurer because I was a banker, obviously. And I got my ratings, my instructor. We were doing static lines then, static line training then. So I got my static line instructor rating. I ended up doing most of the training, and all of a sudden, the guys, the other club members weren't doing much, and it was me doing most of the work. And I remember so well at one of the monthly meetings we had, I was a little frustrated. I said, folks, this is not Danny Smith Skydiving Club. It's the Charlotte Skydivers. I need help. I said, if we're not going to get help, we just need to turn this over to a commercial operator. And he said, okay, you're it. And I said, okay, I'll do it. And I did it out of frustration, and that's kind of how it got started. So I took it over, went on from there. We was on a little grass strip then in Midland, North Carolina. The landowner would only give us a month-to-month lease. And I said, well, this is not going to work. At the time, when we started at Metrolina Parachute Center, I brought in two partners, Amy Powers and Jim Burkhalter, and we decided, well, we got to find a different place to go. And so we did. I heard about Chester. I'd never been there. And Chester was noted for glider operations, Bermuda High Soaring. So after skydiving, one Sunday afternoon, we hopped in the airplane and flew down and looked it over. And I said, absolutely, this would be great. And that's how we got to Chester, where we are now, Skydive Carolina. Met with the airport board that following week and told them I'd like to relocate there and start a skydiving center there. And he said, okay, what do you need? And that's how we got started.
So you are starting in Chester, a very well-known drop zone in the skydiving world today. In two more years, 40 years in that location.
And we're in year number 38.
But you needed a little help in those early days in getting that started. Who was key to helping you get Skydive Carolina going?
Let me back up just one quick moment. Whenever we took up, we started the commercial operation at the Skydiver Club where we was there. Well, the first day that we go into operation, the club voted us in on a Friday night. We opened up Saturday as a commercial operator, Metrolina Parachute Center. And at midnight, we called our insurance company on the airplane and filed out. It was an agent out of Florida. So we just left the message. That's what he told us to do. Just leave the message if you're going to do this. And we did. Now, Saturday afternoon, pilot runs the airplane out of fuel and crashes it. I didn't even know if we had insurance on it at the time. Fortunately, we did. So the reason I'm backing up to this part of the story is that now it's crashed and it's got to get rebuilt. And I reached out to Gene Paul Thacker, one of my original mentors, and I said, Gene Paul, what can I do? He said, okay. And he lined it up where we could take it to get it repaired. It had to be trailered in, obviously. And he said, I'll have you an airplane next weekend. So I had one of Gene Paul's 182s for that before we moved to Chester. And then, of course, you know, I got the airplane back. We had that. And then I was buying my partners out at the time because they had full-time jobs as well. And so when we got to Chester, I added a second 182. And that's what we operated to start with, two 182s. That's what we had, two Cessna 182s. And then I bought my third partner out, which was Amy Powers. And she was very good at what you do. She did a lot of advertising and marketing. And I bought her out, so now it's just me. And then one year, Jim West from Skydiving Xenia, Ohio, he said, hey, I'd like to come down there and bring my Twin Beach down. We're closed down in wintertime just to have a spring event at your place. We did. Well, I ended up, that was my first twin that I bought. I bought his Beach 18. And we operated that for several years and then decided that, you know, we're getting close to maybe going into the turbine field. Well, I didn't know anything about any of that. Who calls me? Paul Fayard. Hey, Dan, I got an idea. I was still in my banking career, too. I was running the drop zone part-time on the weekends. Have an idea I'd like to talk to you about. I said, okay. So he flew up, met him for lunch. He said, I would like to put a King Air at your drop zone. And if I got this correct, I'm pretty sure it was. I know it was one of the first of Paul's leases, so to speak. And so that's how I got started in the turbine field. I leased my first King Air from Paul Fayard. And the rest, as we got bigger and bigger, we went from a King Air to a Twin Otter. And then I was leasing from him. And then I got to the point where I could afford to buy. So I bought a King Air from him. And then I eventually bought a Twin Otter from him as well. But with that, oh, and so the backup for that, even before that, I need to go back for my first 182. That's when we got started. And I went to the Freak Brothers convention, and which Roger Nelson put on at the time. And I didn't, on our way out, I'd heard about Roger Nelson and his big operation. So we stopped. I had a couple of friends that went with me. We stopped at Skydive Sandwich, Illinois, which is the forerunner to Skydive Chicago when Roger was running that. I was blown away when I saw his operation. Four Cessna 182s. He had an Island, twin engine Islander. If I'm not mistaken, he had 60 static line rigs in there. It was amazing. I didn't know him, never met him. So go to Freak Brother Convention, do that. When I get back home, back in my bank, I call Roger up. Said, hey, I'd like to come talk to you, but I'm operating a skydiving center, but I need help. Just some advice, I'd like to come talk to you. And he said, sure, come on. So I came out there, went out there and stayed with him for a week, jumped his Islander, did some jumps with him. I left there, and that's the first time I met him, and the first time he met me. I left there with student parachute systems, three barred radios, a tandem rig, didn't have a tandem instructor, but I had a rig, and I didn't have a 182 at the time either. And so he said, well, I got one down in Skydive Miami, I'll send it to you. And that's Cessna 98 Golf, which I still have to this day. And he gave me all that, and then he sold me that airplane for $10,000. And I didn't have the money to pay him for 10 up front. So he financed it for me, $2,500 every six months for 2 years, no interest. And he got me started with equipment and radios and taught me how to train students, basically. And that was my start with him. And then fast forward back to when we got the Chester in 1986. And then my third mentor is Paul Fayard. And what a man. I mean, he's just incredible. You just did a podcast with him, and he's an amazing story. And I thought I knew everything about Paul, but through your podcast, I even learned more. But anyway, Paul came with that idea about leasing me a King Air, which he did, leasing me an Otter, which he did, and I ended up buying both from Paul. And he's still my guy. I mean, he's with what we have now. We've got two super vans, and Paul helped me get those as well.
Danny, give me some insight here with each of your mentors. I never met Gene Paul. He was before my time. It sounded like he was a little, you know, from what I've heard, a little rough around the edges, but a heart of gold. I've met so many people who speak of the generosity of Jean Paul?
Let me tell you about Jean Paul Thacker. He was a no-nonsense guy, and you did it his way, primarily. But he had a very soft heart for airplane owners. I found that out. Because when we crashed our 182, he didn't have to send me an airplane. He did. He didn't have to help me get that one repaired. He walked me through the whole process of doing that. I found out, and anytime I needed an airplane part, and I didn't know anything about it, I would call him, and he would help me out. And he was amazing. And then he was the our first Mid-Atlantic director that I was familiar with. Anytime I had a team question about anything in skydiving, I knew I could call on Jean Paul and do that. And, oh, my gosh, he ran all the meets at the Carolina Sport Parachute Council, the style and accuracy meets. And just an amazing man. And he would. He would help you out in anything you want to do. But he was a no-nonsense guy. He was. And, in fact, one time we even had a little issue because at my drop zone, I didn't let anybody jump unless they were 18 years. I did it first, but we went through, you had to be 18. We didn't go through the 16, 17 parental consent. Well, we had a meet going on, and he sent up one of the commander's daughters, or son, maybe it was, that was 16. And I said, no, can't jump. Okay, he's not 18. And that was the advice of my attorney, by the way, in our decision. Well, Jean Paul wasn't there at that meet, but boy, did he get mad at me for that. I kind of found the wrath of Jean Paul after that one. But I said, I'm sorry, I can't do it. I'm not going to do it. I'm not going to make a rule here. So we didn't let him jump. And for about a year, he was mad at me over that. And I didn't like that because he was one of my mentors, someone I looked up to. And finally, I buried the hatchet. I went, come on, Jean Paul. I'm sorry, but that's just the way it was. And other people told him the same thing. Jean Paul, you really shouldn't even be, that shouldn't even be considered. And so he backed off, and we became good friends after that. And until the day he passed, I mean, I highly respected that man for what he, for who he was and what he did.
Shed some light to me on Roger Nelson.
Oh, what a man.
I didn't meet Roger. I've seen videos. Obviously, I've worked with Melissa. We know Rook. And obviously at that time, people either loved Roger or hated Roger. When I watch videos of him, he seems so charismatic and like a dreamer that was dreaming beyond what people thought was possible. And it almost seemed like to me that he was okay if you weren't with him. He was going to be his larger than life personality and come with me. Let's go conquer amazingly big things or not, but we're going to do amazing big things. And he did.
He absolutely did. I was just amazed. He didn't have to lend me three parachute systems, three radios, a tandem rig, and an airplane. He didn't know me. I didn't know him. He did all that. And he thought outside the box so well. I mean, the things we're now using today in student training is because of Roger Nelson. First guy to put square mains on students. I never dreamed of doing that. And I said, that's crazy. No, it wasn't. He did that. He did so many things with the student program, again, that we're still utilizing ourselves at Skydive Carolina today. And that man was such an inspiration to our sport. And he was. He was kind of a love-hate guy. I get that. And at the time, I even think USPA was concerned about him. But I'm telling you, there are things that we do today, and it's because of Roger Nelson, especially in he was passionate about running boogies. He was passionate about student training, and it was evidence. I mean, when he put on the World Freefall Convention, we had the C-130 in there. What did he have there? Somewhere between 4,000 and 5,000 skydivers, and it went off without a hitch. I mean, the man was brilliant, and I've been to his drop zone many times when he was alive. I went to all the World Freefall Conventions, all of that. And in fact, when he flew in one time in his Twin Otter to my drop zone and spent the weekend with me, oh, I cherish that because that's the last time I got to see Roger alive was when then. And we just talked for hours and hours and hours about skydiving. And he was just an amazing man. He really was.
What a great story. Let's touch on, before we move on with your story, another person that was very important to you, and that was Ted Strong. Can you share some insight about Ted?
Absolutely. Ted Strong when we started really growing big and I got into tandem skydiving in a big way, I went to Ted through a recommendation, and I was just amazed. Again, another one that I was just amazed about, and that I told him what I was going to do. And at the time, I didn't have a lot of money to buy, tandem rigs at the time. Now they're like, what, $13,000, $14,000 in there, about five or six was still a lot. But I was able to get some financing, and I bought three rigs from Ted. And it's just amazing the support that I got from Strong Enterprises, and especially him. And I remember, there's so many Ted stories I can tell you about, and I'll try to keep it brief. But one interesting one is that he was doing a test drop on equipment for the military. We had these 55-gallon drum barrels. You might remember that.
I was there.
You were there. And and they came up, and we leased a CASA from Gene Paul, from Paul Fayard, to do the drops out of that. And the drill was they were going to jump out, release that barrel, and then a round parachute was coming out to drop it to the ground for the military in a military operation. Well, something happened because the AED didn't work right. And they go, as you know, they went barreling into the woods. Thank God they didn't hit any buildings or anything. And I'll never forget that because Paul, Ted came in, we talked. I said, Ted, I can't do this. We got to stop. He said, I know, we got a problem here. I said, we got to go back to Orlando and figure out what we did wrong, which he did. And then he sent me, I have it on my wall in my office, in my skydive office. I got the neat, when Ted was honored, I got the neatest, no, when Ted passed, I got a picture of Ted when he passed, but also got, he sent me a card after that event, and thanking me for his drop zone, sharing me, very complimentary about it. He said, there's only one thing wrong with it. He said, you're too far away from me or I'd be there every weekend. But I owe a lot of respect for Ted Strong. He was a great man.
I know many DZOs have a great Ted story. He was a gentleman.
He was a total gentleman. I had PIA meetings, the PIA symposium. I've had dinner with Ted and his managers many times over because I always wanted to when he was there. Cause he was another one of my mentors in that respect, especially from the tandem side. And just to be with him, I knew Ted when he actually started in Michigan before he moved to Orlando. So just another amazing man. Yes, very good. Thanks for asking that question, sir.
If you're a fan of the 20-Minute Call, I'd like to personally invite you to become a member of a budding community on Patreon. By becoming a patron of the show, you can join me behind the scenes to discuss options for future guests, chat about things we've already heard, and gain access to some show swag. Details on how to become a patron can be found in the show notes. I'd love for you to join me. Okay, on with today's show.
Danny, let's come back to your story now. You'd started Skydive Carolina in 1986, but you took retirement, early retirement from First Union in 1994 or so?
94, I believe it was, yes.
And really, that's when Skydive Carolina really became a full-time drop zone.
That's correct. Prior to that, we were just kind of a weekend drop zone. And be honest with you, I spent 28 and a half years in my banking career, and I loved every 26 years of that. The last 2.5 years, the bank started going into this merger craze, and I was on the merger team for the department I was in. I went through 32 bank mergers in 2.5 years, and it just got crazy. And I just got so tired of corporate America, and I loved it for 26 years. And that's a whole different story, but I just said, enough's enough. It wasn't fun anymore to get up and go to work for me. And yeah, I left a ton of money on the table, but I didn't care. I wanted to go do something that I wanted to do and enjoy getting up and going to work. And so I took an early retirement package when I turned 50, and I left First Union and then Skydive Carolina went full time.
Any regrets?
No. I missed, the decision was correct, except for leaving all that money on the table. I like to have it now. As you know, running a skydiving center can drain you in a hurry. I'd like to have that part of it. But no, the only thing I miss about it is the people. Because I was a manager. I had three managers under me. I had 40 ladies working in my department. and three managers that reported to me, and then I reported to upper management at the same time. That's what I miss. I miss the people, the friendships, and all of that. And I do, I really enjoyed those 26 years. Those last 2.5 were not too much fun.
Danny, let's get into Skydive Carolina. Now it's going, you're still jumping a lot, and you retired. And then a jump would forever really change your jumping career. And that was you broke your neck.
Yes, I did.
Can you share the details of that story?
I remember it like it was yesterday.
What was the date of that?
It was in 1994. Yes, 1994. How it happened was that back in the early days of me running and owning Skydive Carolina, I didn't have the staff that I have today. I did everything pretty much. There were times when we were doing static line training, which we don't do anymore, obviously. I was training. There were days where I trained, flew the airplane, jump mastered the students, ran manifest because that was a one man operation. But on that particular day, one of my packers was the son of George Brownlow, Ryan Brownlow. And by the way, Ryan Brownlow is a swooper that competes on the national level today. Still, somebody still does it. He lives in California now, but at the time, he turned 18. So he wanted to do, they were going to do a tandem, his dad bought him a tandem jump, which he did. And then we did, that's when we did formation around the tandem jump itself. He wanted me on the load. Well, one of my pilots, Damon Hearn, was there that day, and he was a skydiver. And I had a brand new Sabre 1 parachute that only had less than 100 jumps on it. And so Damon was packing it, but it had not packed very many zero-turn parachutes, zero-porosity parachutes. So he was packing it. And so then I went to Damon. I said, "Hey, Damon, I'm going to jump next, so I'll need it when you get done packing it." Well, he didn't get the slider in there seated like it should have been. And so we did the jump. We track off. I track off. I wave. I look up like I always do. And then I deployed. And then I pull the throw out the pilot chute and deployed. And as I'm looking up, watching the parachute, I always would take a look up and watch it fill up with air. When I looked up, that thing, boom, was out. The slider was down. It opened like running into that wall at 120 miles an hour. In fact, people on the ground said it sounded like a cannon went off when it opened. And my head went forward. I didn't know that I broke my neck. I thought I pulled a muscle. And I reached up to grab my toggles and got them released. And I was going to reach up to stow my slider, but it was so painful. I said, "Forget that." And I just made a big round circle, and I landed near the pea gravel pit that we have. I landed by one of the jumpers on the jump, Callie Kowalski, and I just bent over. Said, "You okay?" I said, "No, I think I pulled a muscle in my head on a hard opening." They sent the golf cart out to pick me up. Well, that thing was bouncing over the land. I said, "Stop. I can't take this." So I walked in from the ground and into my office. And I laid down. I said, "There's something wrong here. Call 911. I need to go have this checked out." So it's kind of an interesting story. So I did that. That was on a Sunday night. I get into the hospital in Rock Hill, South Carolina. And they only had an orthopedic surgeon on duty that night. As soon as they did x-ray, they noticed I had a broken neck. They wouldn't touch me. They were scared to death. So they were going to send me to Charlotte, to the big hospital in Charlotte. Well, it turns out, I knew that Charlotte has a helicopter service, so I knew the operators of that. I said, "Well, call them and tell them to send so-and-so down here to pick me up at the hospital in Rock Hill." And so they called and came and said, "He can't do it." They just had a massive pileup on I-77 in Charlotte, and they're transporting all these people back and forth to there. So I had to wait, and they were so scared that they wouldn't touch me in Rock Hill for fear that I had to check. So I laid it on this board, and I was in pain. And they wouldn't even put a pillow on my neck or anything. They had to even wait for an ambulance from Charlotte to come pick me up. I got in there at 9:30 at that night. I didn't leave Rock Hill until almost 1 a.m. And when they finally rolled me on the gurney to put me into the EMT ambulance, the EMT guy said, "Hey, you look like you're in a lot of pain." I said, "I am." He said, "Let me put a pillow on your neck." I said, "Thank you." So anyway, long story, we get up to Charlotte. Well, when I get into the emergency room now, it's like 2 a.m. in the morning. Every emergency room was filled with somebody from that wreck, and they couldn't put me in a room. So I'm laying on a gurney in the hallway, this lady comes in there who'd been in a gunfight, and she's just screaming and shouting and yelling. She said, "Kill me! I just want to die! I want to die!" And I finally grabbed this nurse wife. I said, "Get me away from that woman! Put me in a broom closet! I gotta get away from her." Long story short of the story. So Monday morning, my neurosurgeon comes in. He had seen the X-rays, and that's when he said, "Yeah, you've got a broken neck. It's very near your spine." And he said, I'm just going to tell you straight, you should be paralyzed from the waist down, and you're not. We're going to operate right away. He said, we got to do that. We got to get this fixed right away. And that put a scare in me. It really did. Well, when he rolled me in there to do the X-ray, now because it was so close to my spine, they didn't want to put me under until they had to put a breathing tube through my nose. They didn't want to do that until they got it in there, but they didn't want to bed me, because in case they hit my spine, I could let them know something was wrong. That's when I got scared, because it took these two guys trying to get this breathing tube in my nose 30 minutes. Sweat's rolling off of them, and they kept saying, "You okay, Mr. Smith?" And I'm just like, Well, they get it in finally, and I go under, and next thing I know, I open up, I'm in recovery, so everything was okay. But of all that, when they were trying to do the breathing tube was the scariest part of that whole thing. It just was. But yeah, after that, and then my neurosurgeon, all my visits back with him, we talked about it and told him what I did. He said, "Well, I don't know about skydiving," because what they found out too, by the way, when they did that, my upper four vertebrae are all fused together from birth. I didn't know that. I was in pain a lot once in a while. I thought that was from me looking up, talking students down all those years, but it wasn't. And then the lower two vertebrae was from the break. They put bone in there out of my hip, or metal actually, and got those together. I've only got a couple, two working vertebrae left, so I can barely turn my head one way or the other. So after I got back, recovered from all that, I obviously wanted to go back skydiving, but I said, you know what? I don't know about this. So I went up and I made a few jumps, just doing clearing pulls, 5-second delays. I never took it back to terminal. And then I just made a decision. I dodged the bullet. Guarantee me 100% that I'll never have another heart opening. I'll skydive all day long. You can't do that in skydiving. And so I decided that I'm not paralyzed. I can still operate this skydiving center. I'll still be involved in this sport. I'm just not going to go jumping anymore. And I made a few, like I said, about 40 jumps after that, doing clearing pulls. I never went back to terminal velocity speed after that.
Wow, it's remarkable that you stayed in the sport for as long as you have, really not actively jumping, but still very much part of the fiber of the community and trying to make Skydive Carolina better all the time. And I will say, by the way, that what comes to mind, which is funny to me, is I've known you for a very long time. You and I met roughly around 2000. You used to have a bad knee.
Mm-hmm.
And yes, you had a broken neck, but a lot of people that would come to me like, "Oh, is he okay?" And I thought that they were referring to your neck, but because of your bad knee, you kind of limped around the drop zone quite a bit. And there was a little bit of a bend in your knee back in the day. And everyone thought that was a skydiving injury. And there was nothing to do with skydiving in that knee.
Yeah, let me tell you a funny story about that, because it's kind of funny. I had four operations on this knee, this right knee, three of them before I had a total knee replacement. That was the fourth one. And how that happened was sports all the time. The first time that I hurt it was when I was in the Air Force. I slid into home base. I was on the fast pitch softball team. I slid into home base. He blocked the plate, and that's what happened. So I had to have it operated on. That was back before they had the scope and all they do now. So they had to cut it to go in there to clean it out, and it was torn cartilage. Well, as I found out later, it was a military hospital that did it. They left half of the cartilage in there, only took out part of it. Well, that was a mistake, I found out later, because the other half just kept breaking off. So fast forward years later, when I had to have it scoped a couple of times, they said, "Yeah, so there's a bunch of just broken bones just floating around in there. That's why you got this bend and all that." So finally, when it turned, I had to have a total knee replacement, my doctor says, "You don't have to do this." That's when I had the banana leg. It looked like it was bent like a banana. And everybody would comment on that, like you said. So he went and said, "Yeah," I said, "you don't have to do it now," I said, "but it's going to affect your back eventually. You need to do something about it." I can't remember the gentleman's name, but I was at the Nationals in Scott of Houston. you know, Scott especially. And he said that, he said, because he was like, hey, he was a friend of mine, I can't remember his name right now. He said, what's wrong with that? And I told him the story. He said, well, I just had my two total knees done. I said, you need to do that. I said, that'll really change your life if you'll do that. So when I got back, that's when I went to the doctor. And he said, yeah, you don't have to, but you're going to eventually. And he said, you may have back trouble if you don't. So I decided to do it. And I did it. And by the way, my doctor told me, he said, he can usually do that operation in an hour and a half. It took him 3 hours on my knee because there was so much debris just floating around in there. He said, you should be in pain. I said, well, I'm really not. He said, you should be. You're lying to me. He said, we literally had to cut your leg off, clean it out, and then put your leg back on there. And so the funny story is after all that, because then I can stand up straight, right? I go to my field guy, Rusty Blast, Rusty Darby in Chester. I walk into his office one day, and I'm standing up straight. He says, there's something different about you. And I said, really, Rusty? What's that? He said, I don't know. What is that? And I said, is it because I'm standing up straight? Yeah, that's it. What'd you do? I said, well, I now have a total knee. So I got rid of that. So, and, you know, that was several years ago. And it did. You know, as you know, we've done it. I've played racquetball. I played golf, all that. And I can't bend it like I can do my left, but it's fine. I mean, it's fine.
And do you have any neck pain?
Once in a while. I mean, again, I can only bend my neck so far each way. But very rarely. I mean, if I force it back, then I can feel some pain. But, you know, I've played golf with it. I play racquetball, and you know about racquetball because I got you into that sport one time. I've hit the wall with my neck a couple of times. And funny, I was towing the 182 into the hangar one night, and I slipped and fell right on my back and hit my neck. And boy, I laid there for a minute, and I had my head. I said, oh, did I broke it again? So I have to be kind of careful. And what's my neurosurgeon told me, he says, all I can tell you is it's healed as best it's going to heal. He said, yeah, are you subjected to a car accident or something? Sure. He said, I can't tell you about skydiving. That's a choice you got to make. And I did. I made that choice that my 2 feet's going to stay on the ground.
This podcast is sponsored by Beyond Marketing, the digital marketing agency for the skydiving industry. Now, I'm not a fan of lots of ads during a podcast. I mean, who likes ads? So I'll stop talking about how marvelously wonderful Beyond Marketing is. But if you're curious about what the amazing people of Beyond Marketing do to help drop zones and manufacturers thrive, then you should check out their website at dropzone.marketing. That's dropzone.marketing. Danny, we're going to wind down here, but I want to share with my audience how you and I met. Because I think it was, you certainly bettered my life. I think you would say that I bettered yours. It was what I refer to on this program as the crossroads moment. I'm always curious about seemingly insignificant things that happens to someone that would then change the course of their life. And that's what happened with you and me. For me, and that was, I was working as a golf professional. That's really how I got, you know, coming to the States for school. And I was working as a club professional, and I'll never forget it. It was this old white Chevy Astro van with not the greatest logo on the side of it.
I still have it.
And you still have it. That is amazing. That thing is a relic.
It was bought brand new, by the way.
And it said Skydive Carolina Parachute Center on the side of it. And I was all of 21, 22 years old, 23 at the time. And I thought, oh man, I remember a childhood friend that had done a tandem in Australia. And I was real scared of the thought of skydiving. And I thought, gosh, if she can do it, I can do it, and I'd like to try. And this is the moment that would change the course of my life, is taking my business card and leaving it on the front windshield with a little scribbled note that, could you please leave a brochure in the pro shop? And I went out and did a couple of lessons, and this was the driving range had lights. So, you know, I came in well after dark and came into the pro shop, and there was a brochure left with a little note going, well, I've actually kind of need some golf lessons, been struggling for the last 19 years. And from there started a friendship.
Yes, we did.
You know, we did a barter trade. I think I gave, I don't know if it was one lesson for a tandem or two lessons for a tandem. It seems like it'd be more appropriate for two lessons for a tandem. I landed from that tandem and I knew I had to do more. And then our arrangement continued through AFF, and during my AFF training, you essentially were my coach. You always talked me down, and you quickly became my skydiving coach. I was your golf coach. And we've always, whenever speaking to each other, I mean, I've been calling you Danny, which is very unnatural for how we speak to each other, because we always call each other coach.
That's
all these
correct.
Years later.
Yes.
During my AFF training, and this is really pure luck, I think you give me more credit than is due, but we were playing a playing lesson, and you ended up getting a hole in one.
Yes.
And it was almost as if, you know, it just sort of sealed the deal for our relationship. Our relationship continued, I think, for a good 3 years of me trying to get down to the drop zone whenever I wasn't working as a golf pro to then start fun jumping. And the long and short of it is there was some drama at my golf course. I was on a working visa because I was not a U.S. citizen coming from the Caribbean, and I needed another job. And because of the baggage of paperwork and being that golf pros were a dime a dozen, I couldn't get anyone to hire me. And because you were a big fan of golf, you and I took a road trip down to Orlando for the PGA trade show, which is, I mean, just an enormous trade show.
Yes.
And I did probably half a dozen or so interviews, and no one wanted to even think about hiring me. And we're driving back, and I'm pretty despondent. Like, you know, my days in the U.S. are done. I'm going to have to head back to Antigua. Not that that's such a terrible thing, but if you want to do something more than a tourism-based occupation, there wasn't a lot to look forward to in that. Here's the thing that's real interesting is, this was 2003, and you were just coming off of El Nino in 2002. It was a brutal year for skydiving.
Yes.
That 2002, it rained nearly every weekend, and you were kind enough to say, hey, I need a little bit of help, and I'm willing to sponsor you. And you were like, I don't have a lot because of the year you had just had, but you were willing to take a chance on me. And man, I needed that lifeline.
Well, it's two-way. That's... I can think back when that happened, and then fast forward, like you said earlier in this interview, we have done so much together, so many things outside of skydiving as well. And I'm telling you, there's a lot of people in this sport that I owe gratitude to, and I've shared that with some. I'm not going to name everybody because I'll leave somebody's name out, but there's so many people that's helped me along the way. And I'm not just saying it's because we're great friends and we're doing this interview. You think outside the box so well, and whenever I finally got you to come to work for me, then you became my general manager. You're handling our advertising. You brought our skydiving center to another level that I could have never done, and you did that. And it is, and part of what we're doing today, a lot of what we're doing today, is the work you did, Coach, when you were my general manager, and you know that. And I this friendship is one of the absolute best that I've, one of the best I've ever had. That's why we're still many, many years later. I'm almost out of words to express my gratitude of what you mean to me and your family. I've met your mom and dad, your sister. What a great family. And meeting your mom and dad, I know why you're so nice, because they're extremely nice. And I wouldn't trade what we've done over the years for any amount of money in the world. You mean the world to me, Coach. I know, and I know we have this back and forth, and I'm just speechless sometimes thinking about how important you've been, not just to me personally, but just to me as my general manager at Skydive Carolina. We owe you a lot. I do.
Man, Coach, I'm so humbled. Well, we had a run. We had a run there, and man, it was.
Can I tell about a funny story between you and I?
Yeah, sure.
You remember that? So James and I, we go to a movie one night, and it's Miracle on Ice. If any of you know what Miracle on Ice with, that's when the U.S. team beat the Russians, and it was a tearjerker. So we're just, he and I got the movie out. And we did have one seat in between the two. We're both bawling, but we wouldn't look at each other. I'll never forget that night because it was so funny. But that was one of the fun times. And just one thing I want to say about you as a golf coach. What you're doing for the skydiving industry is second to none. And we're so lucky to have you doing what you do in Beyond Marketing. It's amazing what you've done for all these skydiving centers, especially mine. And just so people know how good of a golfer you were, when I started working with this man, I was something around, if anybody knows anything about golf, I was about a 28 handicap. This guy got me down to a 9 handicap. Now, I'm not that today, but that's what I got down to because of his skills, his expertise, and his coaching ability. And I owe you more than you'll ever know, Coach.
Oh, thank you, Coach. It's hard to receive that. You know, the respect between us is very
amazing.
Mutual. I needed someone, and you were there for me, and I think we were there for each other.
That's my point. I needed you as much as you needed me at the time. That's it. So it was an easy decision on my part. I'm just glad you were able to come to me when I couldn't pay you a lot. We did get you a pretty good salary before you left.
Without a doubt. No, I was well taken care of. Gosh, what a run. Thank you for those kind words. Let's to protect our audience of hearing each other gushing about our appreciation for each other. You've now been running Skydive Carolina in 2 more years. It'll be 40 years.
Yes.
38 years. And as I tell a lot of folks, or particularly if there's young DZOs that call me, I'll tell them this isn't your normal type of business. This is going to throw you some curveballs that you can't imagine. And it's not linear. And I often say, because of my days with you, man, it is tough to want to not have too many fuel delivery fees. You might order 3 to 4 weeks of fuel in one shot and then be on 30-day payment terms, and then it rained for 3 consecutive weekends. And the financial pressure, you know, the stress that goes on when you lose a member of the community through fatalities, or, you know, have a major event and it just rained for days on end. Or, I mean, it's just, you know, drama, stress. Sure, there are great days. There's a lot of tough days. With that, how is it you've been able to maintain your zeal for this when you could have walked away a long time ago?
My love of the sport. In fact, I'll be going, just on a side note on this, I'll be going to my 14th national in a row this year to support our teams. We have 2 teams that's going to be competing at the Nationals at Skydive Chicago. I live vicariously through these teams because I was a competitor at one time, never got to compete at the level they do today. I love it, and that's what keeps me going. I've had so many people at my age say, when are you retiring? From what? It's stressful at times, but it's still also a sport I truly love. And look what it's done for me. I met you through this sport, by the way, along with so many people. And that's why I don't want to name names, because I'll forget somebody, and I just can't do that. And I had a lot of sleepless nights. Anybody that's a DZO will tell you that. And there's been ups, there's been downs, but the ups far outweigh the downs for me personally, and that's how I look at it. And when there's a crisis, case in point, just two years ago, we had 206 jumpable days at Skydive Carolina. We lost 90 days to weather. 65 of those days, we didn't even open up the doors. That's almost 50% of our business right there, but we survived that. Back during 9/11, I was leasing planes then from Paul Fayard, and I remember that. And I was leasing a plane. And I said, Paul, I can't afford this. He said, yes, you can. We're survivors. We'll get through this. Don't worry about your lease on the airplane. Pay your people. You'll catch up with me later. He allowed me. I got $57,000 behind on leasing planes from Paul. I paid every penny of that back the next year. No interest. And that's the kind of man he was. But the thing it is, I've been a survivor in this. And I've been through some tough times with the business, but I've been through some very favorable, memorable times that I'd walk through this all over again just because of that. And the people I've met, not just at our drop zone, you know, the Roger Nelson's now Rook. I knew Rook. I saw Rook when he was 5 years old, you know, a little kid. Melissa, I got a good conversation with her after Roger passed. That was I'll never forget that. So all the people I've met, Dan BC, there's another one. Shannon Pilsner. Shannon is a great friend. By the way, one of his first accidents was at my drop zone when he was at Georgia Tech. So many people I've met through this. I can't name everybody that I'd leave somebody out, and I don't want to do that, but there's just a couple of names. But it's been a struggle at times. I would go through it all over again because I love the sport of skydiving. And my legacy when I leave here is that I just hope everybody realize that it's not about the money. It's about running a safe drop zone. And we've had our accidents. Every skydiving center does. But that's what my legacy, I want it to be, is that safety first, not money. Safety first.
Coach, I don't think we could end on a better note.
This has been entertaining, fun for you and I both, I think. But I'm just so proud of you, Coach, for what you're doing for our industry. I just want to say that again. And this podcast, oh, my goodness. I am enjoying, you know, it took me a while because, you know, I'm not high tech like you are. I'm kind of old school when it comes to that, but you taught me, you got it on my app so I can listen to it now. I'm enjoying every one of these. And our industry needed this, and thank you for doing that for our industry.
Thanks, Coach. I'll tell you, you're not making anyone more proud than my mother, who listens to this podcast religiously every Monday and texts me, letting me know her feedback on that week's interviewee. So I can already see in my mind my mom smiling from ear to ear as she's listening to you put praise on her, as she says, her firstborn. But thank you, Coach.
Well, on that note, and I'll finish on my end, I love your parents to death, and the next time they're in town, if I don't get to see them, I'm going to be mad at you because they are so much fun to be around. They're great parents. They raised a great son.
Thanks, Coach, and thank you for being a great mentor to me.
Thank you, Coach. I enjoyed it.
Pleasure. Hey, everyone. Thanks so much for listening to the 20-Minute Call podcast. Please do follow us on your podcast app so you always have the latest episode, which is released every Monday. If you want to contact the team, our email address is podcast@beyondmarketing.xyz. This episode was edited and engineered by Garnet Snydrick of the YouTube channel Blue Skies Fun Days. Thanks for listening, and join us next week for our next episode.